Hi again, everybody, and welcome to Amron's Podcast, episode 129. It's Tuesday, November 18th, 2008. The elections are finally over, and Jason and I have finally started to be able to recover a little bit from that ordeal. And we're back today to sort of wrap up some of the loose ends from that, talk about where things are at and where we're headed and such like. How are you?
I'm very relieved.
To say the least.
Yes. It's it's going to be an interesting couple of months in Washington, D.C. It's gotten interesting already. I guess all the hotel rooms are sold out, and there is stories in the news on television and in the newspaper about people renting out their homes for the inauguration. And in fact, I was got off at Metro Center, which is the metro stop that I get off to go to work, and they were handing out flyers. Rent your home today for 2009 presidential inauguration. Earn $1,000 to $5,000. Rent for a day or a week. Over 1 million people need housing. Hotels are sold out. Act now while people are still looking. Limited time only. First 100 homes listings free. I would assume that they've passed that probably already. And this is... So. It's 2 months before. So it's going to be really interesting.
Well, I knew of plenty of people who said that they wanted to go. But the thing is that my impression is that it's almost impossible to get anywhere near where you'd have any sort of a good line of sight or anything.
I mean, unless it depends on when you get them. I don't know, because there are fewer bleacher seats this time.
Oh, okay. So it might actually be a doable sort of thing.
Well, I mean, you're not going to see him unless you, like, camp out days before, but yeah. I'm going to go down. I think it'll be an incredible day, and I'm definitely going to be going down and seeing it.
And because of the time zones, that'll be my birthday here.
Well, that's true. Happy birthday.
Yes.
And how old will you be? Oh.
21 plus, as my grandmother used to say.
That's true. It'll be the 21st anniversary of your 29th birthday.
I knew that
would get you because it's math.
I know.
Maybe by then all of the races will finally be decided.
Yeah.
Maybe there'll be a senator from Alaska and one from Minnesota and one from Georgia. And I guess there are four or five House races that are sort of still outstanding.
It's hard to believe that in this day and age that it can take that long to sort out elections. Throughout the U.S., even in relatively, small population areas, they still have trouble getting all the votes counted in a timely manner.
Well, I don't think it's that they have trouble counting them. It's just, all of this stuff happens. It's just we're not aware of it because of the fact that usually the margins are such that it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
There are very special rules for provisional ballots and absentee ballots, and although I don't quite understand why, I guess they counted some in Alaska on Friday, and they're not going to count the rest of them until Tuesday. But I don't know the reason for that. But I'm thinking the Democrats going to win.
Where?
So Sarah will stay in Minnesota. In Alaska.
Oh, yeah.
She sounds like she's from Minnesota, but anyway. And then there's just the Georgia and Minnesota races. And then the Georgia races, because the Republican didn't get 50%, they're having a runoff December or something or other.
And in Illinois, there's been a lot of jockeying for who is going to be appointed to fill out the remainder of Barack Obama's term in the Senate, since he's now resigned from the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And there had been some speculation that the governor, Blagojevich, might appoint himself, since he doesn't stand a snowball's chance of hell of being reelected in 2010 as governor. I don't know exactly what he would accomplish by that, because he wouldn't be elected senator either.
Right.
So I don't know what that would accomplish for him or anybody else. Then
change of view, better salary, I don't know.
Well, it would get him out of the way. And on the plus side, it might mean that... he wouldn't become the lightning rod for Republicans to attack in the next campaign. Although, surely, if he has any sense, he's not even going to bother running, because he doesn't stand a chance of winning. But be that as it may. Some of the names bandied about for the seat have been Jesse Jackson Jr., Danny Davis, who's a former alderman in Chicago, Tammy Duckworth, who's an Iraq veteran and who was almost elected to Congress in 2006 in a Republican district. Several people, basically, are bandied about. Some people are insisting that they must appoint, that Blagojevich must appoint an African American to the seat since it's held by an African American, or was held. So there's a lot of maneuvering going on as to who that new senator is going to be.
So they just fill out his term.
Yes, because okay. the seat is up in 2010. All states do things. Each state does things differently. In Illinois, certainly, when there's only a couple of years to run in a term, they don't bother holding a special election. If it had been, say, 4 years to go, I don't know what the rules were. I haven't kept up with that. Mm-hmm. I just know in this case, it's just simply an appointment by the governor.
Right.
So that'll be interesting to see who he picks. Hopefully, he'll pick somebody fairly decent and position them so that they can run for a proper election in 2010, which would be nice.
Yes.
Yeah. So also speaking of Illinois politics, of course, Obama's first real appointment was naming Congressman Rahm Emanuel as his chief of staff. Mm-hmm. And Rahm was the congressman from the congressional district right next to the one that I lived in. The seat was once held by Dan Rostenkowski, who was
a
very powerful Democrat until he was felled by corruption and things. Now, I have to admit that I've never particularly cared for Rahm Emanuel. I find him divisive. I find him too conservative for my tastes and a bit too perpetually grumpy. On the other hand, it seems to me that his appointment is a good thing in that it sends a clear message that Obama intends to get things done. And he's not waiting around to, you know, appoint some nice person or what have you. He's just getting right on with it. And also that, I would think, would help his transition team focus on the important roles in the cabinet and so on, because he's got this, you know, strong person in there to keep things moving.
And that you sort of need an enforcer in that type of a role. The thing that I have found rather amusing is he's turned to, you know, a lot of sort of the players in the Clinton administration, and they're sort of grumbling about, well, is that really change? Is this really the third Clinton term? And it's sort of, well, if you are going to tap people who have experience, the only other Democratic administration you can go to is Jimmy Carter's.
Yeah.
You know, so it seems rather silly, and it's not the third Clinton term because Obama's the president, and that he is going to make, you know, all the difference. But I thought it was rather amusing. It's like, well, is this the change we wanted? And it's what happens once they're in there that matters. It's not it's not necessarily. I mean, it matters to a certain extent who they are, but he's going to say this is what we're going to do, and that's what they're going to do. So
and until the cabinet is fully appointed, it's too early to make those kind of rash generalizations about, oh, this is just another Clinton administration. Well, you know, wait and see, because I actually think there are going to be quite a few surprises ultimately in who he picks.
Yes.
I mean, just today he sat down with John McCain. Now, obviously, well, I presume that McCain is not going to be in the Obama administration, but
no.
I do think that we're going to see them working much more closely together than anyone would have thought was possible even a week ago, say, because McCain does. I think McCain genuinely does want reform, and clearly Obama does too. So it would certainly help to have somebody of McCain's stature helping move the reform agenda ahead.
Right, and they can sort of return to the role that he's most not familiar with, but comfortable with, you know. And there are a lot of things that they agree on.
Absolutely.
You know, closing Guantanamo, torture, immigration reform, the earmarks, campaign finance. You know, there's a whole host of things that, you know, I could almost see him, Obama, saying to McCain, here are my ideas on immigration, draft a bill, and let's run with it. I could see him doing that, you know, and that's... You know, that's one of the, I think, great and hopeful things about what he's trying to do.
Yeah. And, of course, speaking of Clinton's, one of the names... Ooh, sorry. I hope you probably heard that I bumped something on my desk. One of the names that's been bandied about lately is the possibility of Hillary Clinton as being Secretary of State. And I have to admit, I never considered that as a possibility.
No, neither did I.
It's an interesting idea. I don't know if it's going to happen, but it certainly could make for a very interesting time.
Well, as a couple people have pointed out, there, of course, there's the thing with Bill Clinton and all his entanglements or, you know, sort of stuff around the world. But Obama is going to have to concentrate almost exclusively on the economy. So you want someone who is very high profile and I think would be, I think she could be an excellent choice. You know, she knows lots and lots of people because of her, you know, time as First Lady, because of her travels, because of, you know, her experience within the Senate. And I think she could be a really important part of his team.
And I would think that it would also help to start to heal any of the remaining rifts, few though they may be, within the Democratic Party between the diehard Hillary Clinton supporters and the Obama supporters. Because, I mean, I still hear some of the sniping going on, I have to say. And it would be nice if there could be a way forward. And
yes.
Having her as the arguably the senior member of cabinet could be a really good step in that direction, particularly mm-hmm. such a high-profile position.
Well, yeah, and from all the things that I've read and I've heard, is she just went wherever they needed her, wherever they sent her, she went, and she campaigned very enthusiastically for Obama. And if the financial end of Bill Clinton can be worked out, and if she really wants it, I think he is going to appoint her. And as also has been pointed out over and over and over again, is this is a campaign that did not leak anything. And so for this notion that to have her name just sort of come out, they're seriously thinking about it.
Yeah. And when I first heard it, I thought that it could be some sort of trial balloon to see what kind of reaction it got. But the Obama campaign didn't do much of that either.
You know, no.
It wasn't just leaking. They also didn't. They tended to play things close to the chest until they knew what they were going to do and then went ahead and did it.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, that sort of segues nicely into the opposition, the Republicans, and where they're going to go from here. Because they were handed, although there's, as you pointed out earlier, there's still some races that are undecided, they were handed a pretty stinging rebuke by the American
people. How long did Moses wander in the desert?
I've forgotten now. Was it 40 days and 40 nights, or am I thinking of something else?
Oh, no, that's a lot. That would be how long it rained.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Moses was like, they were wandering around for a long, long time.
Hey, I may have been a preacher's kid, but that doesn't mean I paid attention.
Well, you know, I thought you might be able to know this stuff. It's a very Southern party. It's a very white party.
Yeah.
It was very interesting. They came up with this, but the United States is still a right-of-center country. And as I mentioned on my blog, the problem is that they're a far right party now.
Yeah.
You know, they really and truly are. And if the notion is that Sarah Palin is their, and what appropriate word to use, savior, nudge, nudge, wink, wink, I think they're in huge trouble. And I must have, finally, we had enough of her. You missed it, but the media onslaught of her after the election was unbelievable. She was on everything under the sun.
I've been getting a bit here.
Yeah, in part because of everybody leaking in the McCain campaign about how, you know, she was such a stupid idiot. So I don't know where they go. I don't know how they reach out to minorities.
Well, you're raising some very valid points. First of all, the poll results show that the party is, as you said, overwhelmingly white. And overwhelmingly old, relatively speaking, because older voters tended to go for Republicans in large numbers, less so for the Democrats. That also has implications for other issues as well, as we'll talk about later. But the people that are being talked about right now as being the future of the Republican Party are Sarah Palin still, Tim Pawlenty, and Bobby Jindal, or however you pronounce his name.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all really conservative. Some more so than others. Tim Pawlenty is arguably probably the least conservative of the three. But Bobby Jindal, or whatever the heck his name is, was just in Iowa to open some fundamentalist Christian meeting thing because he's one himself.
Right.
how does that move the Republican Party forward? If they've been captured by the fundamentalist Christians, mm-hmm. how are they going to move past that to embrace the vast majority of Americans who reject those ideas?
Right. I thought what was very interesting, Mark Shields, who's a commentator on the NewsHour and one of the other programs that I watched, talked about the sort of the differences between the Republicans and the Republican and Democratic parties. And the Democratic Party is captured, you know, the young vote. And so he's talking about, you know, kids who are getting their first homes and, you know, not kids, but, you know, people getting their first homes and they're sort of first figuring out what their careers. Well, the Republicans, they won older voters. So they're going, the Republicans, their demographic is going from their house or their home to a nursing home to the funeral home.
Yeah.
And at some point in time, if you are not able to attract younger people, they're going to wither and die. If you don't have any sort of people of color in your party, I think what's been pointed out over and over again is that I think this generation is sort of post-race. Not that there aren't huge still problems, but it's not, it's, oh, yeah, well, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's a large majority of that. And when you can't have a message that appeals, I don't know the message the Republicans send to Hispanics is on immigration, and that somehow everybody's the notion that you're all here illegally.
Yeah.
One of the reasons why they lost California was because Pete Wilson's whatever that proposition was, which he, you know, shoved down, or not shoved down, but they voted in California. I'm not sure if it passed or not, but essentially every election since then, the Democrats have won that state, and I think that was in 94. Hmm. Bush's father won California, but they haven't won it, the Republicans haven't won it since. And so then putting together a winning electoral margin, it's like when I, you know, blogged about the election at 9:35, Obama was elected president.
Hmm.
And in watching the coverage, you could tell they weren't going to call it, but they knew Hawaii and California and Oregon and Washington at 11 o'clock were all going to go for Obama, and he was going to win. And it was sort of, and you could see they knew.
Yeah.
Because they were saying, well, you know, how does John McCain win? And one of the guys says, well, it's one of the commentators on CNN, I think it might have even been Bill Bennett, and says, well, it's practically impossible. And they all knew. You could see that they all knew. And so with that, you know, that 76-odd electoral votes, you know, if you constantly lose the West, and now if you're adding Nevada and Colorado and New Mexico to that, you know, sort of take, that's another 19 and Arizona, which would have gone for Obama. So that's another 29 electoral votes.
Hmm.
You know, that's a huge, that means you've got to flip. You've got to win one of those big states.
Yeah.
You know, even if you win Florida, that's only 27. That doesn't even, that comes close to balancing it out, but you start to run into problems.
Yeah, and the Republicans have not seemed to have gotten the whole message of this year's elections. They just look at, they say, oh, well, it was a year of change. We were Republicans, the party in power, the party of a historically unpopular president. So, of course, we were against it from the very beginning. They're basically taking a fatalistic approach instead of saying, now, hang on a minute, if we had done a few things differently, how might the campaign have turned out? And
yeah.
The fact that they're appealing primarily to older voters, the fact that they're selling messages that don't resonate well with younger voters ought to be a concern for them. And simply turning again and again to the same sorts of people as if that's somehow going to miraculously save them
right.
is just stupid. They really need to have a deep rethink about where they're headed. But I don't know that they can, because if the party machinery has been taken over by the fundamentalists, there's not much chance of them.
Well, there aren't any moderates left. Another thing which I thought was very telling about the two campaigns and the reason why they aren't winning the, you know, young voters is that Barack Obama used a BlackBerry all the time. John McCain didn't even know how to use one.
Yeah.
That, in a snapshot, is the difference between the two parties.
Yeah, and the Obama campaign was brilliant about using Facebook and YouTube and Twitter and all of the various other new technologies that are out there. And certainly podcasts were promoting him. you know, basically anything that could be used was being used.
Right. And
the McCain campaign didn't even seem to understand the technology, let alone the implications of it or how to use it.
They also sort of brought up the fact that one of the reasons saying that it's still a right of center country is because of all the ballot initiatives that passed, you know, marriage ones,
yeah,
and stuff like that.
But that's actually another example of where the Republicans are at. They're still pushing divisive social issues as if that's somehow a good idea. California is a good example. They pushed this divisive amendment to take away the right of gay people to marry, to re-ban gay marriage, and yet Obama still won the state handily, despite that.
Right.
So clearly, they weren't achieving their goal, which was to increase the Republican vote. And it came across, despite their victories, as mean-spirited, as inherently grumpy and negative. There's nothing positive about any of the ballot initiatives that the Republicans were promoting this year. They were all intensely negative. Now, as it happens, I'm thinking that they may have inadvertently sealed their own doom, because they've become increasingly hysterical in the days since Prop 8 was passed. The Mormon Church has been singled out for its role in enacting Proposition 8. It's a campaign that they've been working on for at least 10 years. And now they've got this sudden faux horror that they're being singled out, when clearly they raised at least half of all the money that was spent to ensure adoption of Proposition 8, and up to 77% by some reckonings of the money that was raised came from Mormons or the Mormon Church.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they are uniquely responsible for what happened. And of course, that campaign was built on lies and distortions. It wasn't, we have these honest differences of opinion. They deliberately set out to deceive voters.
Well, yeah. On this issue sort of in particular, but in issues sort of generally when things fail, what is really important, and I think you go after the Mormon Church. You know, they helped raise the most amount of money. They pushed this, and now all of a sudden they're going, oh, well, this reaction, it's like, you know, you can participate in the political arena, but there's going to be a reaction. Now, reap the whirlwind of this. What is extremely important, this is my belief, but I think it's extremely important, is that this has failed. And I'm talking about failed initiatives sort of across the board. And this, you know, once people have lost and they're, you know, have this great investment in it, there is sort of this release of anger about the people that voted against it. And I am reminded of my mother's old adage, which I think is so appropriate for this. You'll know it when you hear it, and it is: we don't call our brother stupid, even if he is. And sort of the first reactions from some people is, well, anybody who voted for that is a bigot.
Yeah.
And my response to that is, well, okay, you're wagging your finger in front of somebody's face, and you're calling them a bigot. So that's really going to bring them around to your point of view. Because I'm assuming at some point in time, you're going to put another initiative on the ballot to make it legal for gay marriage in California. And again, this is the notion of whatever the issue might be, you need to be really careful about who you target. I think the Mormon Church is fair game. I think Dobson is fair game. But in just some of the things that I saw, it lost, it was almost 50-50 with whites, Asian and Hispanics. It was like 53-47, and blacks voted against it overwhelmingly 70-30. All right, how do you change that?
Well,
all the black community, oh, they're all bigots. Well,
no, there's a lot of things going on there. And when in the initial flush, the day after, there was a lot of the sorts of things you're talking about. I think that with time and a bit of distance, that has shifted now, where the activists aren't so much calling the voters bigots as the people who promoted it, because undeniably they were. The main Yes on 8 group was run by a bigot, and they were supported by bigots. The voters weren't necessarily bigoted,
right,
although many were, let's be honest. Many of them were bigots.
There's no question.
However,
about that,
many of them were just uninformed, they were uneducated. They misunderstood the way the wording was, that if they voted yes, they were taking something away. All these kinds of things.
Right.
There are a lot of issues that play there. But
the important thing is that this is sort of, if push comes to shove, and people are slightly informed on an issue. It's the whole notion, if you're confrontational to them and you're saying, oh, well, your beliefs are completely wrong, because we know if you say that to someone, they go, you know, gosh, Arthur, you're completely right. My belief system is completely wrong and yours is completely right. That's not going to happen.
Yeah. No,
so you need to be really careful, the tone.
Yeah, and
there's really careful.
There's a certain hardcore of voters in any state, but let's just stick with California. There's a certain hardcore of voters who will never support you, not for generations,
right,
until they die off. And that's just a given. We have to accept that and move on. But there are a whole bunch of other people that are reachable. Now, a lot of the Christian right, in particular, it keeps going on and on and on about the fact that 70% of African Americans voted against it. And they're doing it for two reasons. One is that they want to reinforce African Americans continuing to oppose same-sex marriage. And the other is that they want the largely white gay political establishment to turn on the African American community. Why? Because African Americans and the gay communities are the two parts of America that the Christians hate the most. And when I say Christians, I mean the extreme fringe Christians, not in general. It's easier sometimes to use one word. But I'm talking about the James Dobsons. Focus on the family, American Family Association, Liberty Council, all of those sorts of groups. They hate
people running the Republican Party.
Yes. They hate gay people. They hate black people. I don't think anybody can seriously argue otherwise. And by promoting this talking point all the time about the turnout of the African-American community, what they're hoping to do is to drive a wedge between the two. Now, as it happens, the two communities have a long history of working together. Some of the most famous African-American civil rights leaders of the past were, in fact, gay, secretly,
right,
in many cases, because of the times. Nowadays, the groups are always working together. Recently, a whole rainbow of organizations representing Mexican-Americans, Asian-Americans, African-Americans joined forces in a lawsuit to overturn Prop 8 in the California Supreme Court. And one of the groups that was involved was the NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, which was started by Thurgood Marshall, who, of course, is one of our greatest Supreme Court justices.
Right.
And so clearly these alliances are still there. But if you start to break it down, you find within the African-American community that, again, there's an age issue that gets in, depending on how old they were. They were more or less likely to vote for it against it. But also religion plays a huge part in the African-American communities. And anybody who does, any white person who doesn't understand that doesn't understand the African-American community. They saw it not as a civil rights issue, but as a religious issue.
Right.
And the problem that the No on 8 people had from the very beginning is they didn't take on the religious aspect of it head on in the beginning. They did a very soft sell kind of, oh, well, it's not nice to vote for this kind of approach. Whereas they should have addressed it full on, because that's where the battle was going to be. If they had been able to reframe it in its proper context, which is as a civil rights question,
right,
it could have been completely different.
Right.
And we'll never know, obviously. But but I guess what I'm getting at, basically, is that I'm not the least bit worried that 70% of African Americans voted for it, because they only make up about 10% of the California population. They, by themselves, wouldn't have been enough to sway it, probably. And I don't think it's relevant. I mean, you could say, well, 49% of whites voted for it. Why isn't their race an issue?
I mean,
if you're going to talk about race, it seems to me it ought to be across the board. Why did 53% of Hispanics vote for it? Well, again, it's probably religion. You know, all these sorts of things. But I think your point about not calling the voters bigots is a good one. But I also think it is fair enough to call out the organizers as bigots, because
there's no question about it, you know.
But the whole thing about these initiatives now, at least in the short term, has moved into the streets. This past weekend, there were demonstrations throughout the U.S., cities big and small, and some hugely successful, some not. Now, I have to admit that in the past, I have been somewhat critical, saying, well, where was all this energy when it would have done some good? But the fact of the matter is that the people are taking interest now, and ultimately that's all that matters, because you want to move things forward.
Well, sometimes you need a kick in the butt or another part of the anatomy to get going.
Yes.
The other thing, just sort of propositions in general, which I'm wondering about, is I looked in, and unfortunately I don't remember which state it is, but the number of signatures you need to get in some of these places should be much higher. It should be a little bit more difficult.
Especially if you're talking about a constitutional amendment.
Yes, it should be a little bit more, be more difficult to do, put something on the ballot than, you know, in some places it's not even 10%. To get it on the ballot, it's 10%, but it's not based on like registered voters or the number of people in the state. It's based on the number of people who voted in the last election.
Yeah, in California, Ordinary Ballot Initiative, now this is from memory, a Californian listener can correct me on this, but from memory, an Ordinary Ballot Initiative requires 5% of the number of people who voted in the last governor's race, and a constitutional amendment requires 8% of the people who voted in the last governor's race.
It's just too low.
It's way too low. A constitutional amendment should also require a supermajority. It shouldn't require a bare 52% to pass. It should require 60% or 65% because it's too important. You don't want to go mucking around with the Constitution because some fad or because some fever has gripped the populace, because the whole point of the Constitution, and this is a point that a lot of the GLBT activists have been making, is that it is meant to protect the minority from the tyranny of the majority. And in California, you've got a bare majority of people who voted in favor of tyranny. There has to be some sort of safeguard to prevent that from just running roughshod. And it's not just in California. I mean, this is across the board.
In more general terms, you shouldn't be able to change it at the drop of a hat.
Yeah.
You know, you got over 50% by one vote, and it's kind of like, no. I mean, and maybe some of the initiatives, yeah, but I agree with you on a constitutional amendment. You should have to get, I mean, in Congress, it's 2/3 of the Senate has to pass it, and then 2/3 of the state have to pass it. It's not 26 states.
Yeah.
It's how many 2/3 would be.
Yeah, right.
Which I was up late Sunday night, and I'm not doing the math, but one of our many listeners out there can email a comment or call your listener line and tell us how much. I think it's like 33 or something like that.
But it is 33.
It should be more difficult to do.
Yeah. Yeah, I completely agree.
Also because these things happen all the time. Oh, let's put initiative on the ballot. And it should be slightly more difficult. You shouldn't have to get, well, you need to get 50% of the people, or you need to get a quarter of the people. I think that's unrealistic. But I would think 10%, you know. And I will say, however, I do like the notion of that it's not registered voters, but it's people who participate in the election, because I think that's fair. I don't think it's, you know, you have tons and tons of people who can be registered as voters, and it's just not fair to have that as your base if, you know, only 50% of them show up.
Yeah.
I think that's a realistic thing to go by, but I think the percentage should be higher.
Yeah, and also,
well, you had an election.
Yes. It didn't turn out the way I wanted. And of course, my last episode, I talked about it a bit, because I am a Labour Party supporter. However, so far, things seem to be shaking out reasonably well. We've had some interesting developments. The minister in charge of welfare, basically, is...
welfare?
She is a solo mother who once was on the benefit herself. So she understands what people on the benefit go through. But she also obviously got herself off the benefit and did really well in her life, since I think as a minister she gets $250,000 a year and a Crown limousine, if I remember correctly. And she's going to be overseeing the, I believe it's the biggest budget in government, which is $20 billion. So it's
I'm sorry. How much money is it?
I know. We're a small country.
Okay.
But I think that hers is one of the most interesting choices. She's a second term member of parliament. This is only her second term now, I should say. And
how long is that?
She's been in parliament for 3 years, because our government terms are 3 years.
Okay, no, I was just curious.
So I think that was a really interesting choice, and I'm the most interested in what she's going to do. I think she could be one of the stars of the cabinet. I think she could come up with some really creative solutions to, you know, help move people off of welfare and onto work, which left or right, everybody thinks that that's a good idea.
Right.
So that could be very interesting. And also, the incoming Prime Minister, John Key. I can't call him Prime Minister until tomorrow when they're actually sworn in. So he's still incoming or Prime Minister-elect or Prime Minister-designate or something like that. Anyway.
Boy, you do things quick over there in your country, don't you?
The whole thing took 8 days from the election to the announcement of the government. The agreements for establishing it were all signed on Sunday. And then yesterday, Monday, John Key, who is the leader of the National Party, announced the cabinet. Now, the cabinet is, it's different than in the American system because the cabinet, they're all members of parliament, and they are the people who actually run the country. They're in charge of all of the main things, defense, foreign mm-hmm. affairs, trade, welfare, education, health, all of those things. And so they're very important people. It's sort of like the board of directors of a corporation in a way.
Right.
And in this case, all of them are from the National Party because he's come up with separate agreements with three other parties to support the government, but their ministers are going to be what's called outside of cabinet, which means they're ministers, but they're not part of cabinet. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of reasons why that's a good thing. I won't go into that. But the gist of it is that most of the people that I dislike the most, if that makes sense, in the National Party have been relegated to the sidelines. And deservedly so, I might add, apart from a couple of people who I'm not very happy about, and I've blogged about that. But also, John Key has appointed the first Asian New Zealander to cabinet, and he has appointed as Attorney General and Minister for Treaty Negotiations a man by the name of Chris Finlayson, who's the only out gay member of the National Party caucus in Parliament. So I don't know how the cabinet is ranked, but I think that would make him the highest ranking gay cabinet member ever in New Zealand. Chris Carter was Minister of Education in the outgoing government, but I think I must be ranked lower than Attorney General, although I don't know. So anyway, that's what caught my attention, and John Key has certainly so far kept to his word of trying to be Prime Minister for all of New Zealand, and he's steering a relatively centrist course so far, and if that continues, that bodes well, and you know, I may be partisan, but I'm certainly not above telling people they're doing well when they are. And can I just say, and not to rub it in, but I find it really refreshing that the party that I don't support can win, and I can still support things that they're doing. I don't have to just say, it's not like in America where if the Republicans are in power, I'm girding myself for 2 to 4 years or whatever of strongly opposing what they do because they're not going to do anything that I agree with, probably. In New Zealand, it's not as black and white, not as hard partisan. And I find that also, really refreshing.
You also have more parties, and so you have to be building coalitions. You know, you can't piss off a whole bunch of people because they can go, okay, bye, see ya, and the government falls, right? I'm assuming that's what happened?
Yeah, well, technically National is running a minority government because they only have 59 seats in Parliament, which for the next 3 years will be 122 seats. So they do require support from minor parties. And one of those parties is a neoconservative party. And when I say neoconservative, I always mean that in the very clinical sense of the word. I'm not just calling them that to cast aspersions, because they really are a neoconservative party. They're, in American terms, they're almost more libertarian than anything, because they're not really interested in social issues. They're interested in property rights and tax policy and cutting government spending and all those kinds of things. And they are a conservative party, however, still. And they would want to move the National Party to the right, but he's also done deals with the Māori Party, which is more left than right. And so they'll help John Key keep the government more in the center. And that's got to be a good thing, because philosophically, I may be at home in the Labour Party, but certain things I want to see happen, and as long as it takes a centrist course, I'm not necessarily unhappy with that. And the same is true in the U.S. as well. I mean, I may be a Democrat, and I may be a liberal Democrat, but that doesn't mean that I see it as my way or the highway, you know? I mean, I'm certainly willing to compromise.
Well, good for you.
And when I'm
but the whole point of that, which unfortunately recently is that, you know, the notion of compromise, oh, that's some sort of a dirty word. Well, it's the very basis in the United States of why we exist. You know, we don't have a single legislative body with a president that's elected for a single 7-year term. Oh, no, that didn't happen, did it? Because, oh, what did they do when they did the Constitution? That's right, they compromised. Hmm. That is one of the problems that we just, it's become, you know, sort of this dirty word, and, you know, people are going to, well, we're going to stand up and, you know, we're going to show those people, and in the end, it's the people out in the country, you know, oh, I'm it's so wonderful that you stood up for our rights and shot down health care because I now don't have any, yeah, or whatever the issue may be. And that's always, well, it's a discussion for another time, but the notion of sort of the elites and the lobbyists standing up for everybody's rights, but at the end of the day, they don't have to bear the consequences of the lack of action on a certain issue.
Yeah. And that's actually probably a good point to start wrapping up for today, because in future episodes, with the, especially now with the elections over, we'll sometimes be talking about things going on in government, but we're also going to be talking about larger issues, mm-hmm, about issues and about political organizing of government, like you were just saying. And those will be coming up in the weeks ahead. Now, I do have one phone message that I will play just after we leave and before the closing music, I think, and it's from Tom the Ramble Redhead. But in advance, I'll just go ahead and say thank you for the call, Tom.
Thank you, Tom.
Very kind words. And I've had some kind emails and other messages as well, so thank you to everyone. You know who you are. And I think we'll wrap it up for today. What do you think?
All right. That sounds good.
Okay. Well, we haven't set the date for our next one yet, but we'll be back at some point.
And that was very deep.
I don't know. I can't. I like to. My preference is always to say, look for it on such and such a date. But we haven't worked out any schedules yet. We've been too.
No, we haven't yet.
Yeah, but we will. We will. But for now, that's it from Auckland, New Zealand.
And that's it from Washington, D.C.
And they will find you at? I always forget that part.
Oh, I know. They will find me at jasonsviewfromdc.blogspot.com.
And, of course,
That important flyer, if you want to rent your house, you better hurry, you know. $5,000, that would go a long way.
And I will, of course, put a link in the show notes, which are at amrinspodcast.com. And I should mention that some comments have come in on our earlier political episodes, but since they've been a while, I think we'll just move on. But by all means, visit the site and check them out, because they're very interesting. But that's it for today, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Hi. Hey, Arthur, this is Tom. I just want to leave you a quick message, because I listened to your two latest shows, and especially I just wanted to tell you that I really enjoyed what you and Jason had to say at the very end about the election, and it really was so well done and well written. I just had to call. And then I also want to let you know that I really enjoyed you playing that song, Yes We Can, with Barack Obama and all the other musicians. I thought that was really touching, and it really hit home even after the election when, of course, Obama won. So I just wanted to say thank you for doing all the stuff that you did. I think you and Archer and a lot of us did make people think, and hopefully they made the right choice, and like we did. So I just wish you all the best, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
You can leave a comment on this or any other episode of the Amrins Podcast at amrinspodcast.com. You can send an email to me at Arthur, A-R-T-H-U-R, at amrinspodcast.com, or you can ring my U.S. listener line on 206-339-8413. This podcast is produced and distributed under Creative Commons license. Complete details at the website.